Let us pray. Open your word to us, O God, that as we read and listen and proclaim it together, that our hearts would receive your word for your church this day. Through Jesus Christ, your word made flesh. Amen. One of my professors in seminary, Tom Long, who will be here near us next summer at Massanutta Springs, he and his wife are both in leadership for the conference this summer. Tom once taught about something he describes as biblical scholars noticing that the scriptures are filled with inner harmonies, something Tom calls acoustical echoes. He described it as a biblical writer putting something early in a biblical book that begins to vibrate like a tuning fork and that resonates with things that come later in the book. So in that light, I want to read two passages from Matthew's gospel, one that comes early in Matthew and one that comes later. The one that comes from early in Matthew's gospel comes from the Sermon on the Mount. And it has to do with something Jesus said about the human eye. Now, we know today how the eye operates. Light streams in through the pupil, it hits the retina, and impulses are sent to the brain, and we see images. But that isn't the way they thought the eye worked in the first century. In Jesus' day, the eye was thought of not simply as something that received light, but it was also a source of light. That when you looked at something, light actually came from your eye onto the thing that you were looking at. And so the eye, in that understanding, quite naturally became a metaphor for the inner light or the soul. So as Matthew records the Sermon on the Mount early in his gospel, in that sermon, Jesus says this: "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" Then later in Matthew, and this is our text for today, Jesus tells us a story about a wealthy man who wants to take a long trip, but he has a problem. What will he do with all of his money while he's gone? You can't take it with you because there are robbers out there. And there was no federally insured banking program in those days. There were bankers, but you didn't want to leave your money with them in those days. Many people would leave their money with a relative or a trusted friend. But this man decides to do something very unusual. He decides to entrust his fortune to his servants. So he calls three of them. To the first, he entrusts 5 talents of money. It's about $2.5 million in our time. To the second, he gives 2 talents, or about $1 million. And to the third, he gives the 1 talent, about $500,000. And then he goes off on his trip. And he's barely down the road when the first 2 guys run to the marketplace where they wheel and deal and somehow manage to double their money. But the third guy is more cautious, more fearful. He takes his 1 talent, puts it in a jar, and buries it out in the backyard. After a long time, the rich man comes back from his trip. And he calls his servants to him and asks about his money. The first 2 say, "We doubled your money." And the bells ring and the trumpets sound as the news is announced. "Well done, good and faithful servants. You've been faithful in little. I'm going to make you faithful in much. Enter the joy of your master. But then there is the other guy. And here is our text. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You've been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter the joy of your master. And the one with the 2 talents also came forward, saying, Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter the joy of your master. Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went, and I hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. But his master replied, You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow, and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with 10 talents. For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless servant, throw him out into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Friends, the word of the Lord. Well, if you think back to what you learned from studying literature in school, you probably remember that most tragedies have a single plot. A character does something wrong, and because of that tragic action, ends up being banished or killed. When you put that plot line on top of this parable that Jesus tells, you can see what a tragic story it is. There is the character, the 1 talent man. There is the tragic action, burying the treasure in a field. And there is the banishment to the place of outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. But I want you now to put on your thinking caps and help me figure out what exactly the mistake was that this man made in Jesus' parable. What did the 1 talent man do wrong? According to the parable, he was thrown into the outer darkness where there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's the Jewish way of saying his life unfolded to tragedy. But what did he do to deserve that? He didn't steal any of the money. He didn't embezzle it. He didn't lie about it. He gave it all back just as had been given to him. So what's the mistake of the 1 talent man. Now, I imagine some of you may already be thinking, I'll tell you what his mistake was. His mistake was he took that talent, that money, and buried it in the ground. He buried it in the ground. And if you're thinking that, I guess I would respond with a shrug of my shoulders and say, so what? That's what people did in the first century when they wanted to protect their money. You remember Jesus told a parable about another man who found a treasure hidden in a field. How do you think it got there? Somebody buried it to keep it safe. So what's the problem here? What did this 1 talent man do wrong? Well, it won't surprise you to know that preachers have attempted to answer that question. And we've done so in a number of ways over the years. Maybe you've heard preachers tell you that the 1 talent man's problem was that he was lazy. Those other two guys weren't lazy. They went right into the marketplace. They put their energies and ambitions to work, and they doubled their money. But that one talent man, he just sat there on his hands. So don't do that. Be like the other two. Maybe you've heard a different answer. He didn't know he had a talent. Now, let me just say, you may have figured it out already, but the talent in Jesus' parable is amount of money, period. It has nothing to do with talents, gifts, and skills, and abilities as something that we might be able to do. But you know, preachers can't resist those verbal similarities, and so we've made that talent into our talents, and we've said to congregations over the years, now look, everyone here has a talent. Some of you may not have five talents. Some of you may only have two, and then there some only have one. But don't forget, you have a talent. Don't bury your talent. Have you heard that sermon before? Or maybe you heard the answer made popular by preachers in the 70s. This is the answer I grew up hearing. In those days when everyone was reading, I'm okay, you're okay. You know what his problem was? My pastor said he lacked self-esteem. He projected his guilt and his shame onto everybody else, and it paralyzed him. See, preachers have come up with a bunch of different answers to this question over the generations. And we have found the answers reflected in the anxieties of our own age. But what if? What if instead of projecting our anxieties, the worries and frets of our time onto this story, what if we simply stay within the confines of the story as Jesus tells it? What will we say then about what the one talent man did wrong? Well, let's begin by looking at the words that came out of his own mouth. Do you remember? I know who you are. You're a harsh man. You gather where you do not scatter. You reap where you do not sow. I'm afraid of you. Here, take what is yours. Now let me ask, is there anything that has happened up to this point in Jesus' story that would justify that little speech, that would justify that view of the master? Now, it's actually just the opposite. The master has entrusted millions of dollars to his servants. No other first century master would have done something so foolish. Not only that, when they do well, he breaks all protocol and praises his servant extravagantly. Well done, good and faithful servants, well done. No first century master would have done that, but there's more. He also empowers them. You have been faithful in a little, so I will make you faithful in much. Again, no first century master would have done that. And not only that, he welcomes them. Welcomes them into the joy of their master. This is a benevolent, self-giving, gift-giving, trust-empowering, gracious master. I know who you are. You are a harsh man. You reap where you do not sow. I'm afraid of you. Here, take what is yours. That isn't who the master is. That's who the servant is. Sees. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is healthy, your body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, you will be full of darkness. You know, that verse seems to fit into a major theme from Matthew's gospel. For Matthew, to have faith in God is not just a feeling, but it is to see God rightly. If we see who God is in the light of Jesus Christ, God is full of hope and grace and kindness. And if you build your life around that, you'll be full of light. But if you see God as small and punishing, well, if you build your life around that, your life unfolds to tragedy. In the Gospel of Matthew, the God you see is the God you get. The great theologian Karl Barth once said that he spent his entire theological career trying to make the word God a cheerful word again. I think the one talent man is why. What did he say? I know who you are. You are a harsh man. Here, take what is yours. Where do people get that view of God? Well, some people get it from bad preachers and church members. Nothing but hellfire and damnation, as if scaring folks into some form of goodness is what the gospel of Jesus Christ is all about. Other people get it from some bad experience in the church from when they were a child. That's the way it was for a guy by the name of Brian Zond, who has written a new book that's just out called Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God. Maybe you hear the echo of another title, a sermon by Jonathan Edwards. Many of us grew up studying it in school. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. That's the image that Zahn grew up with. He writes, "The image of the angry God haunted my adolescence. Did the specter of the angry God help me behave? Maybe, maybe not. But that's not the question. The real question is not, does it scare kids straight? The real question is it true? The real question isn't, does it motivate people to pray a sinner's prayer? But rather, is it faithful to the God revealed in Jesus?" And Zond admits that he was perfectly happy with that image of God that he grew up with. And he went on to say, "I became a successful pastor with a large congregation because I discovered people wanted to see that kind of angry God as long as it was directed at someone else." But then something changed for him. "The change that occurred in my theology," he writes, came about not by wishing for God to be something other than I assumed God was, but from actually discovering God as revealed in Jesus Christ." And he concludes, "My turning away from an angry, violent, retributive vision of God began after I had turned 40 and while reading St. Augustine's Confessions. His book compelled me to pray what might have been the most important prayer of my life. And here's that prayer. God, I want to spend the rest of my life discovering you as you are revealed in Jesus Christ." That's a pretty good prayer, isn't it? And you know, the older I get, and the deeper I get into the gospel of Jesus Christ, the more I see it. There is more goodness and mystery and wonder and kindness and grace in the world than my tiny theological mind can hold. And given all that I'm seeing in the world today, I think I understand what Karl Barth meant. I just want to make the word God a cheerful word again. Well, let me invite you to stand with me now as together we say what we believe. Christ calls us to live for our neighbors. Jesus broadened the definition of neighbor to include those ordinarily despised and excluded. His life in behalf of others led to persecution and death. He commanded his disciples to live the same way. We believe Christ gives us and demands of us lives that recognize all people in all cultures as neighbors on this planet. Christ teaches us to go beyond legal requirements and serving and helping our neighbor, to treat our neighbor's needs as our own, to care passionately for the other's good, to share what we have. It is part of our discipline to live in simplicity, avoiding greed and luxury that threaten our neighbor's survival. We are obligated to speak the truth in love, to listen with patience and openness, to love our enemies, to accept the risk and pain which love involves.